Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Center for Science and Culture. I'm Robert Crowther, and we're at the Discovery Institute in Seattle today to answer another listener's question as a part of our occasional series, ID Inquiry. Today we have a question about antibacterial resistance, but first let me introduce who's here to answer our question. Joining me today is biologist Anne Gager. Dr. Gager is a senior fellow and director of science communication here at the Center for Science and Culture. She received her bachelor's degree from MIT and her PhD from the University of Washington in the Department of Zoology. She held a postdoctoral fellowship at Harvard. She focused her research there on the molecular motor kinesin. And she is also research scientist at Biologic Institute, where she works in two areas: the limits of neo-Darwinism as a mechanism for change at the protein level, and evidence for the uniqueness of human origins. Welcome, Dr. Gager.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. I have a question that we received from a listener, Jerome, in Olympia, who recently wrote in to ask us this. How does intelligent design explain the fact that the development of resistance to antibiotics appears to demonstrate conclusively that evolution is a fact?
Depends on what you mean by evolution. If you mean change over time, then yes, evolution is a fact. We see that with the development of resistance to new antibiotics all the time. The question is, how much change is required for that evolution to take place? And can we extrapolate from small change to large change, like getting completely new proteins or new organisms or new body systems, etc.? Antibiotic resistance is usually derived from a naturally occurring enzyme. The first antibiotic was penicillin, and the response to that was an existing enzyme called beta-lactamase. It had already been worked out in the natural world that if you were a bacterium, you were exposed to penicillin, the cue was to have beta-lactamase and you would survive. It was floating around in the environment, and it was on a piece of DNA called plasmid that could be easily transferred from one bacterium to another. So over time, as we used penicillin, resistance to penicillin spread through the bacterial world. We had to come up with new antibiotics. They're usually related to ones we already have. We tweak their structure to make them harder for the enzyme to attack. And then the enzyme mutates one or two amino acids, and it can now work on the new antibiotic, but it's only one or two changes typically, one or two amino acids that are changed to conform to the new antibiotic. And it's a stepwise process. You slowly mutate the antibiotic by design, and then the response is bacteria mutate their enzymes, and it just so happens that one mutation confers a better resistance to the antibiotic, and that step's taken, and then another step is taken as you've got lots and lots of bacteria trying lots and lots of different mutations. It just happens. Now, that's not the same thing as getting something new, something different, something that didn't already exist. So, to extrapolate from antibiotic resistance change to the larger kinds of change we have to explain in the biological world is just not possible.
Would this then be a kind of an example of the difference between microevolution and macroevolution?
Exactly.
Okay. So when people use those terms, like you were saying, it depends on what you mean by evolution. Change over time is microevolution. It's almost like adaptation.
Yep.
And then macroevolution would be growing a new limb or producing a new function within the body or whatever. Mm-hmm. Those are big changes mm-hmm. that are a lot harder to explain.
Much harder.
Yeah. Recently, and this may have been why we got the question about antibacterial resistance, there have been a lot of news stories of the first antibiotic-resistant superbug to appear in the U.S. Would this be evolution on micro or macro working presently today?
Microevolution for sure. The reason it happened, the antibiotic colistin was used extensively to treat animals. It's a long practice in agriculture to use antibiotics to increase the rate of growth of the animals they're raising. The only problem is widespread use of the antibiotic means widespread exposure to bacteria in the population, and that increases the chances that the right one or two mutations will take place, and then you've developed resistance to that antibiotic, and then it spreads. Mm-hmm. It originally started, I think, in China, and it's spread to Europe now, and the first cases have been reported in the United States.
And these cases now have moved from the animal kingdom to they're finding them in the first humans.
They're finding the bacteria that are resistant in humans, yes.
Okay. This topic is something that many modern evolutionists say that proves evolution, that it's one of the strongest arguments proving that mutation can increase information in the genome. On the website proofofevolution.com, it actually states, quote, "Since mutation occurs in every generation and at known rates, given enough time and enough duplicated genes, random chance will certainly produce a working gene eventually. Because there's a new gene serving a new purpose where before there was none, we have an increase in information," end quote. How would you respond to that?
A couple of ways. First of all, the use of new is a little slippery there. If you just mean one or two mutations to an enzyme, that's not new. But sometimes evolutionists will use it to say, well, that's a new enzyme because it's got a slightly new function, meaning it recognizes a slightly different compound and can act on it. I don't consider that to be new. You're taking an old enzyme and tweaking it. Our work in our lab has looked at the question of how hard it is to get a genuine innovation, something genuinely new, new chemistry. And we find that it takes more than two mutations at a time, plus the duplication, which counts as a third mutation, plus usually overexpression of the gene that makes the new protein, because the new protein is starting out with very little activity. So you've got more than two mutations plus the duplication plus overexpression. That's more than four mutations altogether that you need in order to get a new function that can actually help do whatever the new function is. That takes, by our calculations in a bacterial population, about 10 to the 15th power years. The age of the universe is about 10 to the 14th power. So the point is, to get a new chemistry, not even a new protein, just a new chemistry for an enzyme, it can take longer than the age of the universe.
And that's just one thing. How many of those have to happen all the time to generate new anything, really, species, functions, so on?
Yeah, you have to get a new structure, you're going to require new proteins and new ways of expressing them in new places. We don't even know how to do that.
Well, this is very interesting. I appreciate your coming in to answer these questions for us. And our listeners are encouraged to keep sending their questions to us. You can send those to editor@evolutionnews.org. And just in the subject line, include ID inquiry. And keep listening to ID the Future at idthefuture.com for future questions to be answered. Thanks for being here, Dr. Gager.
You're welcome.
Hi, I'm Doug Axe, and I have a new book coming out on July 12th titled Undeniable: How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. And I think this book will give you a new take on your intuition about the design of life. If you go to the website undeniabledesign.com before July 12th, you have an opportunity to pre-order the book and receive some gifts. You'll get three books, one called Science and Human Origins, I did a chapter in that, another called Debating Darwin's Doubt that I've contributed to, and a copy of The Unofficial Guide to Cosmos. In addition, you get an opportunity to participate in a private exclusive conference call with me and Michael Medved. where you can put questions to me about the book, and I'll do my best to answer them. So go to undeniabledesign.com before July 12th, pre-order the book, and you get these gifts, an opportunity to participate in the conference call. And be sure to tell your friends and family about the opportunity to pre-order as well at undeniabledesign.com.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute, 2016. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org or idthefuture.com.